Thank you, Greg. He left out accordion player. I play accordion at Camp Buckeye. Well, let me be the first to wish you a happy 35. That's where we are in our count. And when you live God's way, it seems like your life is calibrated to the holy day calendar, which is how it should be. That way you're always thinking about God's plan. And on day 50, we'll have another holy day. And of course, there'll be announcements about that. It's a happy time of year. It's, of course, just beautiful here in Ohio. When I lived out west, this was the time I missed. If Ohio was always like this, people would sell their homes in Florida and Arizona. They would, because they wouldn't be missing a thing. But, of course, we know it's not always like this. I had a picture of our Lakewood front porch, and Taya had our front porch really nice, because she liked to sit out there in Lakewood with beautiful wicker furniture and hanging baskets and ferns and a flag. And I think the house had been painted that year, and one of our friends in San Francisco said, "Why would you ever leave a house like that with a beautiful porch?" And I said, "Because it was that way 4 months of the year." And the rest of the time, it was a bare porch. Sometimes the thing that covered up was white, and you had to shovel it. And that's, but it's just a happy time. Everybody feels good. If there's a favor you want to somebody, ask them now, because people are in a very good mood. It's the time of year when a young woman's thoughts turn to love and a young man's thoughts turn to working on his car in the driveway, or at least it used to be. And the iris outside truly are beautiful. When I see the gardens out there, not only think, as Mark Scapira said today, of God's beautiful creation, but also I always think of Linda Warzycki, because she had a hand in that, as did other people. But it's a beautiful contribution that people have made, and it's going to get prettier. That's the way it is. It is a happy time of year. It's a time of year when life is not hard, and you remember that God's way really isn't that complicated. I was going to say really isn't that difficult, but then I thought, that's just asking for it, Mark. You say something like that, and somehow things sometimes happen. So let's just say it's not that complicated. It can get complicated sometimes, but really, it is simple. And you know, Paul is famous in the second letter to the Corinthians for admonishing the Corinthians for leaving the simplicity that is in Christ. It isn't really that hard to understand. If you turn to John, we'll be in John 14. You get a verse that pretty much sums up our way of life. And it's something that Jesus said to his disciples on the last night of his life before he was crucified, that part of his life anyway, in John 14 and verse 15. In some ways, this sums up living God's life. I'm reading out of the New International because, as you know, I choose translations that fit in my Bible cover that I like. But it says, "If you love me, you will obey what I command." Well, in the King James, and we learned that coming into the church, "If you love me, keep my commandments." In a way, it's a command that Jesus is giving to people. He's reminding them, "I'm not going to be here. Keep my commandments. If you love me now, keep my commandments." And his good friend John echoes that in the book of 1 John, saying that that's how we know we love God, that we keep his commandments. The commandments, of course, God has put in forms that are easy for us to understand. Yes, there are complicated turns here and there, particularly in the days of the nation of Israel, but really, the burden, as Jesus says, is not grievous. It's easy to understand. There are 10 commandments. And of course, there's more to it than 10 commandments. There's also, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," and "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." And Jesus said those were the two greatest. But as far as the rules we keep, the 10 commandments cover it. That's about as simple as it gets. And you would think that people would get that, because there are many people who, protest when the 10 commandments are removed from courthouses or state houses or public places. And I wish they were there too for all people to see all the time. But I have to look at those people and say, why are you so up in arms about this? You only keep 9 of them at best. What about that 10th one? What about remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy? And the Sabbath day is a special commandment. It's not a hard commandment to understand. Sometimes it's a hard commandment to keep. In Exodus 31, you know this verse very well, because when you started learning about God's way, this was a verse that was very important, and we keep it in our hearts for difficult times. But in Exodus 31 and verse 13, God has told Moses to say this to the Israelites. Exodus 31 and verse 13, "Say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths," and it is plural there. "This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so that you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy." Well, and yes, it is a sign between us and God, but it's also a sign to the rest of the world, isn't it? Particularly at that time. Because really, the Abrahamic peoples, the people who have now become known as Jews and Christians and Muslims, people who have that lineage in their beliefs and their culture, are the ones who were the keepers of the Sabbath. Now, the modern Christians have changed it, of course, to a different day. Although it's interesting that if you look in the Catholic Catechism, there's a question that says, what day is the Sabbath? And the answer is the seventh day. And the reason they answer the question that way is they say, but we changed it to the first day of the week. Of course, I'm paraphrasing here. And we did it because the church has the authority to do that. And they rather laugh at Martin Luther and other people who whine and complain about the Catholic Church, because the Catholics have a point. The reason that the Protestants meet on Sunday is because they're basically saying that the Catholic Church had the authority to change the day from Saturday to Sunday. So that's why the Catholics don't worry about the Protestants, but the Protestants have much to worry about from the Catholics. Actually, of course, we're a pain to the Catholics, because we say, you never did have that authority, that that's something that comes from God, and it's something that Jesus Christ and the Apostle Paul and other people backed up. I remember once I was at a wedding reception. A friend of mine got married to, he wasn't particularly religious, but he married a very conservative Catholic woman from a very conservative family. And they love to argue about these things. And I was at a wedding breakfast after the wedding, and the arguments began. They were challenging us all. And I just didn't want to hear it. So I went out and laid in the sunshine. It was about this time of year, between two cars, where I hoped no one would find me. And if I took a nap, the cars would go straight forward or back and not sideways, so I'd be okay. But the bride's brother came out to find me, because he saw that I had left and he still wanted to argue. And he said, well, you have to admit that you're all offshoots of our church. And I think I had one eye open at the time, and I was pretty new in the church, maybe only 2 or 3 years. And I said, and please pardon my French, I'm using this in a scientific way. I said, actually, we consider you a bastard offshoot of our church. And he went back inside and had breakfast at that point. I just didn't want to get into it. But it isn't that difficult. And one of the reasons that the Sabbath is a sign of God's people is that it doesn't make any sense unless God gives it to you. If God says you will rest the seventh day, and I want you to do it, and if you love me, you will keep my commandments, then we keep that commandment. But if you don't keep the Sabbath, not that much happens. There's billions of people who don't observe a Sabbath. Or as my mother said, well, we keep the Sabbath, we just do it on the wrong day. If people do that, it doesn't really affect, as a matter of fact, their lives in many ways are much easier. But this Sabbath is a beacon in more than one way. It not only shows God that you are willing to do what he says, and it shows God, we keep the Sabbath both backwards and forwards. We were talking about this in our youth Bible study. We keep the Sabbath looking backwards because we look at it as the seventh day after God recreated the earth. And when we keep the seventh day, we're proclaiming that God made the earth and he rested on the Sabbath day. And he made things like Iris and beautiful animals and just our whole creation and the stars. But then he rested on the seventh day. So we keep it looking to the past, but we also keep it looking to the future. And that's not something that the Jews or most people who call themselves Christians do. And I was a little surprised that this shocked some of the young people in our youth Bible study. They couldn't answer the question, what in the future does the Sabbath picture? And of course, it pictures the time at the end of man's domination of the world when Jesus Christ will return and will establish his kingdom. So we keep it looking backward and we keep it looking forward. And we're the people, we are the only people who do that. And I mean our big collected group. It's of interest to me that when things happened in our church, you know, you talk to new people and you realize that you end up talking about conflicts that happened in the 70s and conflicts that happened in the 90s and conflicts that happened in the 2000s. And you think, they must all think we're nuts. And yet we still have new people coming in. But part of the story of that is that in the 90s, people tried to say that our church didn't keep the Sabbath. And although there were other issues, that was the last straw for me and the last straw for many of you, is that we knew from living God's way that the Sabbath was important to keep. And I remember at that time that the new leader of that breakaway heretical church, because that's what it was, who's not a part of God's family in any way, said, well, the Sabbath isn't the sign between God and his people. The sign is the way that all men shall know you, and it's in John 15, and you don't even need to turn there because I know you know this, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you love one another. And that's very true, and that is the important sign for other people looking at us. But I ask you a question. If you didn't know people here, and I was outside and I said, would you tell my wife something for me? And they would say, how will I know which one's your wife? And I would say, well, she's a very kind person and a very loving person. And no one makes better scrambled eggs than she does. She's a wonderful mother and has made my life great. They would just look at you confused, you know. That's the equivalent of by this shall all men know. I'm talking about the heart at that point. But if I say she's wearing a blue sweater and a red top, they would say, oh, okay, thank you. And if you say these people are Saturday people, if you say these people observe a seventh-day Sabbath, then suddenly you stand out, don't you? At your school, at your work, at whatever you're part of. Oh, yeah. As they used to say about our kids in high school, the grandchildren don't come out till after dark on Saturday. Everybody has a way of knowing you. At Baldwin Wallace University, they refer to it as Mark's Sabbath, which is theologically very unsound. But at the same time, if they're going to check sunset charts before they ask me to do something for them, then I literally mean this, God bless them. I mean, I've worked to get to that point. And your friends, the world may think you are weird, but it's a sign. And trust me, down the road, when their eyes are opened up, because they will be sooner or later, they will say, wait a minute, even Bob Voyner did that. I should have paid more attention. I should have listened. I thought he was just ranting about things. And God will say, well, some of the time he was, but he was right about the Sabbath. And another thing is that when you work at a place or go to a new situation, sometimes you will encounter people and you won't know that they are Church of God people in one form or another, but suddenly you'll notice that their behavior is strange. And this happened to me in Montana, that a young man would duck out on Saturdays and leave me to paint the house. And I thought, well, something's going on here. I was laughing with Jim Housen about this morning because he went to law school down in Akron with Jason Renew and Brendan Babcock, and the three of them didn't know each other and didn't know that they lived God's way of life till they showed up in church together, and it was a big surprise. It's happened to other people, too. Bertie Gaba and I were both Church of God Seventh-day Saturday people at Baldwin Wallace, and also the ones not eating the bacon-wrapped mushrooms and stuff while our Jewish faculty chowed down on them, you know? And people remember that kind of thing. People remember you when you don't sing in a high school choir on the Christmas celebrations, but when you're gone on the Saturdays, when you can play basketball on a Sunday, but not on a Saturday. And when you are first being called to God's way of life, what is the big test? And where do the big problems come from? They come from keeping the Sabbath when you haven't before. And trust me, you will have all kinds of temptations to not keep the Sabbath. My wife and I were talking to Larry last week about his, as a matter of fact, you should hear his story about Sabbath because it's very uplifting what God has done for him. I hope it hasn't changed since last week. I hope it's still good. But, you know, and Cliff and Frank, other people who've come in and realized that they have to keep the Sabbath and the challenges that have come their way, but the ways that they've also met it. And we look at each other and we identify each other because of that sign. We look in the guidebook and it says, does not work Saturdays, must be Church of God. And we go, oh, okay. So it is a sign for the rest of the world also. And occasionally you'll run into this in other places. It talks about keeping Sabbaths. My wife and I were in a building in Holland, an old building. We can't remember what building it was. It seems to me it was in the city of Haarlem, which is near where she and her family lived. And we saw a painting on the wall, and the painting said the Dutch word that was the equivalent of Feast of Tabernacles. Is it Loftwittenfeest or something like that? Yeah. And, of course, Holland had many Jews and still has Jews, but the interesting thing about this picture was that they were blonde people living in temporary dwellings down by the harbor. Haarlem is now 8 miles from the ocean. You'd have to know in Holland that that doesn't mean it was never on the ocean. I mean, the Dutch people literally built some of the land in Holland, and at the time, Haarlem was a seaport. But across the years, I looked at that picture, and I was just astounded because I thought, those are my brethren. I will meet those people someday. I don't know who they are. I don't know why they're in the picture. I don't know what the circumstances were because Holland doesn't have a big history of Seventh-day keeping people. But obviously they have some. And I've heard of other experiences like that too. It is a sign that not only crosses vast distances, but also times. When you read about people who lived and died to keep a Seventh-day Sabbath, then whether or not they understood everything about God's way of life, you know that those people in some way are your spiritual relatives, whether they did it for the right reason or not. If you devote yourself to this kind of thing, and it isn't that difficult, you stop working on Friday at sunset, and you can start again on Saturday at sunset. That's really it. We do not work. We do not do business. It is a sad commentary, I think, on the historical story of our church family that some of the big clashes in our church, some of the divisions that have actually caused splits and schisms are over the way that people keep the Sabbath. Specific ways that they do it. And people say, well, I cannot be in a church if you're going to keep the Sabbath that way. And I think to myself, I go through the world looking for Sabbath keepers. Why do I want to get in fights with Sabbath keepers? If they're people whom I respect and who know are living God's way to the best of their abilities, then I think it's my responsibility to trust their heart and cut them some slack on this. If they've changed their whole lives to live God's way, and if they do keep the Sabbath, I'm not talking about people who are very lazy about it, but I mean people who do work hard, then we should be able to accommodate each other to some degree. We want to do things right, of course. If something is definitely wrong, then we don't want any part of it. But I think it says something about our mutual enemy that's an issue. That in this day and age when we should all be sticking together because there's so few of us, we fight with each other about the very things that are the sign between us and God. We've all gone through experiences relating to the Sabbath, and it's made us stronger by keeping it. But I want to relate one to you that happened to me. And with your forgiveness, I'm just going to read this. This was a story I wrote back in the mid-90s when things seemed to be falling apart in God's church. We knew that there was turmoil, but we didn't know how to strengthen brethren and how to stay together and how to grow and bond. And I started writing some things. The Plain Truth was our church magazine back then. We called it the PT, And the plain truth had gone way off the track. It was no longer the plain truth. It wasn't simple anymore. It was quite wrong. And so I started doing some writing, and on a copy machine, I would copy it and hand it out. I got tired of it very quickly, because as even the Bible says, it's hard to write a lot. You know, of making of books, there is much weariness. But because of our PT heritage, I named this publication The Piano Tuner, which is what I do for a living, because that way I could say, here's the PT. And some people liked it and some people didn't. But the whole idea was just to strengthen people and encourage people and tell stories. And so, with your permission, I'm going to read a fairly short story out of this. And the reason I'm reading it is I don't remember all this stuff. It all happened, and it was true, but it was much fresher in my mind. That's 20 years ago now. I had to laugh. Taya came into the bedroom this morning, and I was laughing. And she said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, I couldn't remember if I washed my face or not, so I checked, and the washcloth was wet, so I did." And that's the way it is. I can remember things from 30 years ago, but I can't remember if I washed my face yet or not. So you have to play tricks on yourself. But I want to read this story to you about one Saturday field trip that happened while I was at the University of Montana. This was written in February, so it starts out talking about that. This is the time of year when you can feel the light stretching out a little longer towards the end of each day, and the world hurtling on towards spring. Ohio is a fine place to watch the seasons unfold, but at this time of year, I always find my thoughts turning back to the days I spent in Montana. At the age of 18, I transferred to the University of Montana School of Forestry. During my first quarter there, I ended up on the same surveying team as a young man from Syracuse, New York, named Dave Crabtree, and he was the one who eventually taught me about the Sabbath. By the end of the school year, we were good friends. One sunny day in spring, I was studying at my desk on the first floor in my dorm room and heard bluegrass music coming through the open window. I looked out, and there was Dave sitting on the porch steps playing the banjo. Rather than complain about not being able to study, I grabbed my 12-string guitar and headed out to join him. It turned out that that act sealed my fate, because a couple of weeks later, I was offered a job by Dave and a friend of his named Fred, who asked me to be on their crew at the State Forest for the summer. And the reason was they were looking for a guitar player for their band. That had nothing to do with my forestry skills. So I rounded out the band. It was a happy summer, and so it went by all too quickly. By the end of it, I had gotten to know Dave very well. He was the one who turned my mind to God and his truth. He would go into town on Saturdays for church services, and I would sneak church literature out of his underwear drawer. I always returned it carefully before he got back, and he always knew what I would read and would go back to services and tell people what I was studying that week. It wasn't too long after that I started attending Worldwide Church of God services with Dave. Fred and he and a couple of other friends found a house on Beckwith Avenue to rent together for the next 2 years, and when the school year started, I was off on more adventures with a new twist, because by then I was keeping God's way of life. I now observed the Sabbath day from Friday at sunset till Saturday sunset. It sounds simple enough, but as all Sabbath-keeping college students know, it led to many complications, because there were often required classes and labs and field trips on Saturdays. But we trusted in God, to get us through these crises, and things always worked out. And they do. Or at least they did, up until we had to take a course called Range Ecology. Range ecology, the ecology of grasslands, was a required part of a forestry degree. It was taught by a professor named Mel Morris, the oldest professor at the school. Mel Morris was a gentleman. At the forestry school, that meant that he carried around a cup to spit his chewing tobacco in. I have no idea how one spells snooze, that's what it was called. I think any spelling of it is wrong, and it is, of course, chewing tobacco. Mel Morris, everyone called him that, he wasn't Mr. Morris, he wasn't Dr. Morris, just Mel Morris, always wore field breeches and a variety of the most beautiful Stetson hats at the school. He was widely regarded as the expert in the field, pardon the expression, because the field was his study, and we had heard from upperclassmen that this was the quarter to take range ecology from him because it was the last time that he would be teaching it, and he was a legend in that area. Still, he's still known. So Dave and I signed up. There was one big problem. After the course started, it became clear that the labs were on Saturdays. We were pretty sure we could do a lot of the labs on our own because they mostly involved going to various local areas and taking a census of the vegetation. But the biggie, the field trip lab that constituted a major part of our grade, took place at the National Bison Range up in Moise. Any of you ever been to the National Bison Range? It was a place where one of the Roosevelts actually donated some of their own private bison, buffalo, and it's where the buffalo herds of the United States were revived because they were down to only a few hundred bison at that time. They were on the verge of going extinct. So it's famous as one of the places that actually saved the buffalo, and they have a herd of a few hundred. The National Bison Range was Mel Morris's baby, the area where he had done a lot of his own research, and you couldn't get access to the parts we needed to go to unless you were with Mel Morris. So that was a problem. We couldn't do it other days of the week. And that meant you had to be there on Saturday. To us, Mel Morris was intimidating. Older than our fathers, slow to speak, his most famous phrase was the way he drew out the words, by and large. He would start so many classes with that. And he wasn't always easy to understand. He had an odd, somewhat European look for a range man. He didn't look like a cowboy. He had thick glasses and a large, almost bald head, hence the Stetsons, and a jutting nose and chin. He was known to be quite demanding. His tests were difficult, and he was long past being flexible. He didn't have to be. Some of the forestry professors were friendly, and one of the guys, Mel Morris, was regal and distant, and not someone to be trifled with. As the day of the field trip drew near, we knew we had to face our fate. Dave and I made an appointment to see him in his office, a place where you didn't often find him. We knocked on the door frame, the door was open, and had to wait a while before he turned his attention our way. He beckoned us in and motioned for us to be seated. Then he just waited. He didn't say anything, no prompts from him. So we didn't know what to say. I think he was trying to get the advantage on us. Dave, at that point of our lives, I remember, let me do most of the talking by default. He just wouldn't say anything. So I stumbled forward. Mr. Morris, we have a problem with one of your labs, the Bison Range one. What kind of problem do you have? Well, we can't go. Can't go. Why is that? Dave and I, by then, had an arsenal buildup, and maybe you have too, of euphemistic phrases that we would use. We would sometimes say, Saturday's not a good day for us. I didn't ever like that one because that wasn't really true. It was a great day. Or, we have to go to a meeting that day. Or, we have plans that we just can't change. And all of them sounded pretty weak to me when I was sitting in Mel Morris's office. So I don't really know why, but for some reason I simply said in a quiet, forlorn voice, Saturday is the Sabbath and we can't go. Dave squirmed in his chair. He was not very happy with my choice. I wasn't real happy either. Mel Morris just sat frozen in his chair, and a frown started to build. He said nothing, and I was worried at that point that he had swallowed his snooze. He sat for half a minute, frowning more, not looking at us. We had no idea what was going on inside that large skull. Then he stirred, and he started talking slowly. By and large, I don't like this kind of thing. The Bison Range trip is where you learn the most about the range. He stopped and he thought while we prepared for our doom. But I'll tell you what. My wife and I have to go back up that way the next Sunday. I have to do some work there myself, and she helps me out. You could come along with us, and I could leave you in the area you need to look at for most of the morning and check back on you about noon. Do you live nearby? Well, we lived only a few blocks away. Good. You be ready at 7 o'clock. Wear long sleeves. If you don't wear a hat, I'm not letting you in the car. wear boots too, because there's snakes up there. Well, instead of worrying about the snakes, we were thrilled. We couldn't believe it. The great Mel Morris was offering us a way out of our problem in a very generous style. We thanked him and backed out of the office. On our walk home, we were puzzled, but we were dreamily happy. Mel Morris was under no obligation to help us out, and here he was going out of his way to make sure two boys got their lab work done. We decided to quit worrying about it. Sunday came, and we in our hats were ready well ahead of time. It was May, and the sun was up earlier than we were. Mel's long black car pulled up, and we got in the back seat, first saying hello to Mrs. Morris. The 90-minute ride up there was pleasant enough. Mel knew his way around, and all the rangers knew him and even opened the gates for him. We must have been quite a sight driving in that long, I think it was a Lincoln, to the National Bison Range on the dirt roads. But they all knew him, and it was kind of nice. It was like attending with royalty, you know. Finally, we got to a secluded valley at the end of a dirt road with barbed wire dividing one slope down the middle. Mel showed us where we needed to take vegetation counts. We already knew how to do that. And he left us so he could go do his own research. So Dave and I mapped out our plots, and we started counting. First, the grasses, blue bunch wheatgrass and tall fescue and others, and then forbs, which are the little herbaceous plants, the low broadleafed ones. We found plants that we'd been taught to identify, but we'd never seen in the wild. We were chagrined to find invasive exotic species that Mel had warned us about in class sprouting up all over the place, and it's even more of a problem today. He always said their names with sadness, as if they were taking over the range that he loved, which in fact they were. Spotted knapweed, toad spurge, Russian thistle. There were others too. We got through our work there more quickly than we'd expected, and we moved to set up a few more plots. The sun was already hot. That's why we needed the long sleeves and the hats. A meadowlark sang out up the slope from us, which is my favorite bird song of all. They just, Western meadowlarks pour their song into the air. It's so beautiful. We finished the last of our tallies and took a short stroll following the barbed wire fence uphill. The sky was a hot blue bowl above us, but enough wind was blowing to keep things tolerable. It was a fine spring day. We neared the top, and all Montana seemed to spread out around us. The hills would be brown soon enough, but for now, they were an exuberant green song with choirs of flowers everywhere. We stopped to drink from Dave's canteens, and suddenly he pointed to the top of the opposite rise. There at the crest of the hill stood a lone buffalo. There was no other human around. We could see a pair of golden eagles flying high above and the Mission Mountains off to the east. The Mission Mountains are a very special mountain range to my wife and I. Part of our growing relationship happened in their shadow. It was just as though we were the first people to ever see that country that day. What we didn't know was that that lone bison was a sentry. A sentry. We inched our way nearer to the shaggy friend, staying close to the fence, when suddenly he gave a snort, and over the top hill came a whole herd of buffalo. Now, a whole herd there means 300. It's not like the millions that the people in the Old West would have seen. At most, there were 300, but even that made a ferocious noise, and we could feel the ground beating under our hoofs, under their hoofs. Young, old, calves, mothers, bulls, they flowed in a stream down to the bottom of the draw and then stopped and stood and looked around as if to say they'd forgotten what all the bother was for. How many people can say they were that close to a buffalo stampede? We were never in danger, but we were close enough to be left standing there paralyzed with our mouths hanging open. After we figured out how to move again, we wandered back to our rendezvous point, and at the appointed time, the Morrises showed up. He checked to make sure we'd gotten all the data we needed, and we headed home. I was already sunburned and was glad when he stopped and bought us all a Coke. The Morrises were quite cordial to us all the way to town. Before we knew it, we were standing on the sidewalk in front of our house again. It was an unforgettable day. Not particularly surprisingly, Mel Morris never acknowledged us again. We were just two faces in a large class. Soon the academic quarter was over, and he retired, and that was the last I saw him. I got a B in range ecology. I still wondered from time to time what on earth made him so generous to us. Eventually, I quit wondering. Another year went by and we graduated. I worked for the Forest Service briefly, and during that time, I met my future wife. I moved down to Los Angeles to be a piano player and then later to Ohio, and have only seen Dave a few times since then. We both married and had two kids each. In the fall of 1987, my wife and daughter and son and I took a trip out west to see Dave's family and some other friends. It was actually for the Feast of Tabernacles in Spokane that year. And one of our stops was the University of Montana. I wanted to show them my old stomping grounds, and I wanted to see the forestry school again. Classes were in session, so I left the other three outside while I took a quick look in the old building. I happened to peek in an office where one of my old housemates, Mike Sweet, was working, and he said hello, just as if 12 years hadn't passed, and we went outside so he could meet my family. We talked about who was still teaching and who was long gone. He asked if I remembered Mel Morris. Yes, of course I did. Well, Mel had died that spring. And there was one funny thing that came out after he died. His wife, Mrs. Morris, told Mike that Mel's real name was not Morris, that he was actually Jewish and from the East Coast. And when he got into range management after World War II, he felt that he encountered a lot of prejudice, a lot of professional prejudice against him because of his background. So he changed his name to Morris, wore cowboy hats, and purged his life of every bit of Jewishness. I didn't really understand why he would do that, but apparently it was something that gnawed at him later in his life, according to his wife. And then I happened to think, one spring morning, only months before he retired, having built his career the way he wanted it and hidden his heritage from his colleagues, who should wander into his office but two fresh-faced, awkward, wet-behind-the-ears boys, saying they couldn't do what he wanted them to do because they kept a Saturday Sabbath. What must have rushed through his mind in the silent moment that followed? We thought we were walking into a lion's den, but instead God delivered us into the hands of a man who probably didn't even know himself how merciful he would end up being to us. We didn't really change anything in his life, but he gave us the opportunity to make a go of ours. I know that I will never forget Mel Morris. Maybe in the world tomorrow, we can take a stroll through his beloved rangeland some Saturday, and Dave and I will explain God's ways to him. It seems like the least we could do.